Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, so I am, and welcome to a very special interview podcast dedicated to Kenneth Branagh's wonderful new film, the multi-BAFTA and Oscar-nominated Belfast, which has been out in cinemas in this country for a couple of weeks now. You might not think it to hear him, but Branagh was born and raised in Belfast in the 1960s, leaving Northern Ireland behind with his parents when he was 9 years old. Those experiences have formed and informed the semi-autobiographical Belfast, which Branagh wrote and directed, and which centres on a young boy, not named Kenneth, interestingly enough, growing up in Belfast in 1969, just as the Troubles were about to erupt and change life in Northern Ireland for decades. It's perhaps the most personal film Branagh has ever made, and speaking as someone who also was born and raised in Northern Ireland, albeit a very different part of the country at a very different time, I connected deeply with it too. And so, that notion of growing up in Northern Ireland, of being surrounded by violence but also by camaraderie and warmth and love, forms the backbone of my in-depth conversation with Branagh, which was recorded over Zoom recently. We also talk about the impetus for him to make the film now at this stage in his life, the decision to adorn the soundtrack with Van Morrison classics, and how life changed for him when he moved away from Northern Ireland at such a tender age. But as we discovered, you can take the boy out of Belfast, but you can't take Belfast out of the boy. So you can't. Wee buns and all that. Unlike Helen O'Hara's recent interview with Jamie Dornan for the same film, our accents didn't get stronger as this interview went on, although Kenneth Branagh can slip back into the Belfast brogue whenever he likes. And it's startling to hear. Here we go. Me talking to Sir Kenneth Branagh. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined. I almost said we're delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast. So we are by the writer and director of Belfast, Kenneth Branagh. How the devil are you, sir?
I'm very good. How's yourself, mate?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I thought this film was tremendous.
Thank you.
I'm going back to Northern Ireland on Thursday. I don't get back that often these days, but this film felt like it had transported me there in a weird way, because it's not my time period. I grew up in the 80s, and I grew up with the Troubles in a very, very different way. And I grew up in a very, very different place. I didn't grow up in Belfast. I grew up in the countryside. But at the same time, this felt like my childhood. It's obviously your childhood for the most part. Yeah. But that universality, is that what you were aiming for with this movie?
I was hoping for. It took a long time to come around to writing this. And one of the reasons to decide to do it in the end was to feel that I had was at a stage in my life where I could get beyond it being some sort of documentary account of my own childhood, and instead intersect and maybe connect with other people's. It's how I began to approach not giving people the same names, giving it a slightly more mythic quality in my own mind anyway. And one of the things that's been amazingly rewarding about having the film be seen by people is that almost the first thing they say to me is what it tells them about their own childhood. It seems to unlock something. A lot of people who've had to move away from places that were very important to them, people who remember very important family decisions, and also who remember that moment of whatever you might call innocence or childhood before the grown-up world enters in, you know, difficult ways. And in my case, it was quite a sort of traumatic way. But in other cases, people just have that before and after moment when they start to worry a bit in life. And I felt as though the story was arriving at a point where that might be able to be part of other people's shared experience, not just mine.
So in terms of your own experience and how much that is portrayed in the film, what would you say? What's the percentage? What are we looking at here? Are we looking at 50%, 60%, more?
Well, one of the things that makes it hard to answer that question is that you have a nine-year-old experiencing it. And it's that point of view, almost literally physically that point of view quite a lot of the time in the film. And that's a point of view of a kid 50 years away from me. So objective truth is not really available, as the psychiatrists say, you know, the facts of our life are less important than how we remember them. This is how I remember them, with what I hope is an emotional truth, but definitely that contains pivotally the moment when my life changed for sure in 20 seconds, when what I thought was the sound of bumblebees became the sound of voices, became the sound of a crowd, became our street engulfed in violence. That happened for sure, and in the same chaotic, anarchic, terrifying way. I did get involved in looting a supermarket. The film, in fact, reveals that my life of crime has really been an unsuccessful one. Not only there, but in the great Turkish Delight heist, I was also, significantly unsuccessful. So, but those things happened, whether I liked them or not. Not everything that happens that follows is strictly true. It's inspired by rather than directly based on, and that's deliberate. But a lot of it was from the facts of what I saw not happening, not only just happening to my family, but to families around.
Absolutely, it's interesting the way that the troubles, and we're right at the beginning of the troubles as they really began to escalate in Northern Ireland in this film in 1969. It's interesting the way they suddenly crash into the movie. And yeah. I imagine in the writing of this, that was something that you had to be very, very careful about getting that balance. One of the things I loved about the movie was the carefree nature of it. Going back to that idea of idyllic, innocent childhood. And every now and again, and this is something I grew up experiencing as well. Every now and again, the troubles would crash into your life, be it a report on the news or someone, a family friend or something like that, getting caught up and stuff. Was it difficult to strike that balance of that during the writing of this and indeed the editing process?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, what I knew was that the original incident that really had our town, our street, our neighborhood disrupted by this, left a real strong trail of tension. Essentially, once it happened, we were all on code red, high alert for anything like that to happen again, because it did so, it seemed like out of a clear blue sky. In this case, August the 15th, sunshine, a hot August, the summer of love, that weekend, that very day, Woodstock, the pop festival was happening. There was the British music movement was happening. There was a kind of sizzle all over the place. We didn't expect it to kind of burst into flames the way it did where we were. And it left a long taste and a long sense of being unsettled. It's why this lockdown during which the film was written really reminded me of the uncertainty and the unsettled nature that you described so well there, where for me, it made the younger me a much more guarded individual. And yes, you kept getting back and wanting to get back, as human beings try to get back to regularity, routine, simplicity. What did this boy have in front of him? Football, cinema, the girl, church, if he had to. And these things were you attempted to navigate your way back to the normal version of them, but there was always this concern that the blue touch paper could be lit at any time.
Was there a sense, even back then, as a 9-year-old, overhearing perhaps parental conversations, that there was a sense that you need to get out of the country, that was very much the driving force, the impetus behind that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I read a statistic just this morning that across those first couple of years of the trouble, 120,000 people left Belfast. It was a big figure of folk who found that gamble you describe was there. Yes, I think that once it happened, the other thing it did to what you might call the normal life is that I felt like you became a spy. You were listening on banisters. You were hanging around at barricades and you were hearing, the dangerous men with raven black hair often, who reminded you of villains in movies, like the Jack Palance character in Shane, who were from whom you would get, and you'd hear instructions or you'd hear little bits of info. And you had this sense, because your life was in a sense shaped by the way you framed it regarding movies, thrillers and westerns. You were hearing the language you heard in those films from men, mostly men, who often were, as my mother used to put it, trying to play the guy in the big picture. And a lot of people, with smaller minds that were filling a power vacuum, if you like, mm-hmm. at least at the street end of things, not in the more sophisticated political groupings. But yes, there was, we definitely, life was unsettled, and you were in disguise in a way after that moment. And yes, the constant threat, and I suppose what the film ended up for me dealing with more directly than I realized when I started it, was loss. Loss of identity, loss of a home, loss of a nationality, ultimately loss of an accent, loss of, and specifically loss of a loved one. And when the kid is on that sofa towards the end of the film, and the parents are really just slowly trying to drip feed him the certainty of what their decision must be. He is screaming, you know, I don't want to leave Belfast. And I could as easily read into that, I don't want to grow up. I don't want to lose my parents. I don't want to see change. I don't want to have to deal with this thing human beings find so difficult to handle, which is change. Yes, in the screenplay, you were trying to strike the balance between that, the naturalism of that, the pain of that, and then these heightened moments, both for the violence, but also for some of the moments of glamour and excitement. You know, the ad hoc parties that this kid would see like it was the movies, where, you know, I don't know if it was like this for you growing up, but if ever there was a chance for some ad hoc party to happen, if somebody had a bottle of Guinness or a new long playing record came into the street or something, music, song, dance, jokes, whatever, people were up, they were, a hooly would be had. If there was a sniff of a chance, it would be had.
Indeed. It wasn't quite like that for me, but because Belfast for me was very strange, and it was forbidden territory for me, Belfast.
Right. Well, I have no doubt. I have no doubt. And yet for us, you know, the countryside was forbidden territory because that's where dangerous things happened. That's where people got taken to. That's where, you know, stuff happened in the middle of the night, you know, in wherever it might be, bandit country or kidnap country. It was, you know, there was an unsettling air to the whole place.
Absolutely. And I want to delve into some of the creative choices that you make in this film. It is your second black and white film with Michael Maloney. So is this part of an unofficial trilogy? Can we expect something?
Ask Michael Maloney about that. He was it was great to reunite with him. I must say, who's been a big part of my sort of filmmaking life, and to have him play this sort of Frankie West character who is one of the people trying to walk the fine line of sort of joining in with what needs to happen, but keeping one foot in the camp of what went before. You know, a lot of people trying to walk a neutral line without getting into trouble with the various factions. And as he says to the father character, to Pa, he says, we can't all be playing the Lone Ranger. And Michael did a very nice job of trying to be an even more of an everyman than even Pa was.
Because the decision to black and white, was that something that you always... The decision to black and white, I just use it as a verb, but the decision to shoot it in black and white.
No, I like that. That's a new groovy kind of film criticism. I'm liking it. Or is it, maybe it's unique to your podcast work, but if so, I'm thrilled to be part of its inception.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you are. I said to Jamie Dornan, it was always raining in Belfast when I grew up. What was it like for you? He said the sun was always shining. What was it like for you, Chris? Was it rain or sunshine up your part of those woods?
I remember a great deal of sunshine, strangely enough.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. For me, it was rain. It was monochrome. It was gray. It was shades of gray and black and white. And I loved it because it was very sort of monumental. And I felt at home when I watched John Ford westerns, and I would see bits of Monument Valley, and I'd see these massive vertical columns. For me, that really reminded me of cranes in the shipyard that dominated the skyline in Belfast. But black and white, for me, took me back to this sort of grit, to this authenticity, to pictures of my grandparents. And it was really a strong contrast that I felt in my life between that sort of forensic way of looking at people. Color didn't get in the way. But when you went to the movies, as a small person, physically small person, you go into the center of Belfast and go to one of those big picture houses on Royal Avenue. That was a massive event. And the screen size and the screen sound were completely overwhelming and overpowering and transportive. I'd never seen places like them before, whether it was, you know, the made up worlds in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, or at one stage in the movie, The Sound of Music was there. And, you know, that's a very expansive film. Robert Wise, who edited Citizen Kane, directed that movie. And, you know, it's a big widescreen thing. You'll be unsurprised to know that The Great Escape was in this film at one stage as another sort of big European landscape thing with a movie star at the center of it, Steve McQueen, trying to get out of Germany on a bike racing over, or would be racing over barbed wire fences. Those massive widescreen color, Technicolor experiences blew my mind, or it amused me and perplexed me. I say a Beatles film like Yellow Submarine, That I regard as one of the great pioneering trippy movies of our day.
Yeah.
I think that people must have been well stimulated when they were making that film, because it foxed me then. It foxes me now.
I think it foxes a lot of people, that movie. But that movie is so colorful, and there are splashes of color throughout the film, and they're almost always, in fact, maybe always, you can correct me if I'm wrong, they're linked to the arts, and they're linked to movies. And obviously we see there's a play that Buddy goes to with the late great John Sessions in his last role, and These are splashes of color. Was that something that you felt yourself as a kid growing up in this monochromatic world, and you're beginning to develop this interest in acting and the theater and arts and culture, and everything just feels colorful?
It was more about storytelling, but you're right that, yes, color is all the art that meets the lives of these people is in color. It's the stuff that has the brain fizzing. For me, in going to the theater, this real production of A Christmas Carol, 69 December, Joseph Tomalty, great Irish actor, and George Malpass played Scrooge, a big regular character on Emmerdale at that time. They being in the room was a complete thrill. I couldn't understand. I mean, I could have touched them. For me, that was as magical in a different way. And somehow it made a curious kind of sense. But the everything about sort of creativity thrilled me and also perplexed me, because I had no idea how these things were put together. No concept. Always used to wander around at the back of the television and see if I could find the little people. And when I remember seeing a film at the old Capitol Cinema up in the Antrim Road. I don't know if you know this film. It's Old Yeller. Y-E-L-L-E. It's basically a Labrador dog heartbreak picture. And it's an old Disney movie, and it has a whole mournful country song about Old Yeller. Oh, my God, that Polak's me. The Marley and me of our day, as it were. For me, it just hit me the power of what you could do with a story. I saw it in life. My dad could tell a good yarn. Uh-huh. I could see in these improvised hoolies that everybody found a way to capture people's attention. But the stuff that excited me the most was on some big proscenium, whether it was a theater or a film. And somehow that's where escape lay. And when the trouble started, that's where the escape route really pointed.
And is that something, just going back to you, to yourself, is that something that when you moved to England that you very much continued rightfully off? Because I imagine England wasn't easy initially for you.
It wasn't. And, you know, no one's asked me that before. And no, it didn't. No, that all stopped, actually. And what happened instead was we went inside, and where I went was books. That's when I started reading. So first book was the Lone Pine Five, a sort of slightly tougher, sort of famous five thing written by a guy called Malcolm Savile. I bought it for 5 shillings at the Woolworths in Reading, brought it home to my father. He said, "What'd you do that for?" I said, "Well, I wanted to read it." He said, "We got libraries for that kind of thing. What's going to happen to it now?" I said, "I'll keep it." He said, "But you've already read it." "Well, I know, but I'd like to keep it," because he couldn't understand that. There had never been books in the house. But that's where I went. For the next 4 or 5 years, I was a man of book till I was about 16. And then I hit that wave of 70s cinema, Dog Day Afternoon, The Conversation, all of those kinds of movies sneaking into horror films like The Omen, Marathon Man, those kinds of mainstream movies of the time. But for about 4 or 5 years, I stayed in my room and read, basically.
Wow. And what was your accent doing at that time, Ken?
My accent was doing a merry dance, I suppose. I was trying, just like being in the bedroom reading books, I think at school I was just trying to keep my head down. You know, I did whatever you could to fit in. So luckily I had an average but useful capacity at sports. And so that was a passport to a lot of, allowance. It's essentially all the corners of it got rubbed off. And eventually, I think I became the most sort of the most neutral, most suburban kid you could possibly find.
Almost as a defense mechanism.
Yeah, like a disguise. It was like, that was my cloak of invisibility.
Yeah, and accents are interesting in the movie. There's some incredible accents on display, and not always from, not even just Belfast natives, but not even Northern Irish natives. So were you particularly listening out? How keen was your ear when it came to accents in the film?
I think I was pretty particular. I'm always keen about consonants, end consonants. I like whatever the accent. I like the sort of the crispness around the pronunciation to be clear, so that people get a chance. If they're not used to the sounds, I'm certain that they'll pick those up eventually. But you've just got to be clear and yet authentic. So people like Ciarán Hinds, who grew up half a mile from where all of this went on, knew it very well. Jamie Dornan from up the street there in Hollywood, County Down. Katrina Balfe knew this world pretty well. She lived on the border in Monaghan and was certainly aware of how volatile the situation was. And Judy Dench had an uncle, and Uncle Peter used to visit her, who had a rhyme in his very, very strong Belfast accent that she used as her warm-up exercise every day. And when she wasn't, you know, making Jude Hill, her 10-year-old co-star, you know, take her through the accent class before they started a scene. So there was a lot of different kind of colors in the accents. And yeah, I was always after clarity, but I'd also wanted it to be entirely where it was supposed to be from. Hence, casting people who had a very sort of clear sort of cultural understanding of the way people were, the very clear sort of delineations between the way men and women spoke, the sort of tones of voice and the kinds of humor and the sort of joshing between them.
You mentioned that incredible cast, and this has been a very good year for and introducing credits in movies. You know, we saw Rachel Zegler in Spielberg's West Side Story, and now and introducing Jude Hill, who is phenomenal in this movie. What were you looking for, and did you think you'd find it?
Well, we knew that the film really couldn't be made if we didn't feel someone upon whom we could hang the picture. It's a big ask for you know, somebody who was going to be playing nine. We got a veteran of 10 years of age, and he stepped into the breach. We were looking for somebody who could listen and be present. Somebody whose listening wasn't about getting ready to say the next thing that you remembered you wanted to say, but who was really right there in the moment, because at least half of the performance was going to be the reaction on his face, the way the story unfolded. One of the things we did was not rehearse much with Jude, if at all. We would always try and capture every reaction to every scene for the very first time. And usually what you're seeing in that movie is his first take in that first scene. And he was very sharply on it. He was well prepared. And he had that interesting combination for a young person of being well prepared. We encouraged him to be that way, and he noticed that others were as well. But prepared in order to be as spontaneous as you can when you get there, to be playful, because I let them know that we would encourage improvisation in particular places, and he had a great sort of ear for that. So it was his listening ability, and his he has himself a genuine sense of humor. And a very strong personality. He's a Liverpool supporter. The character he plays is a Tottenham Hotspur supporter. And occasionally he had to mention the name of the team. And I promise you, he would not say it in rehearsal. He said, I'll do it when the camera's running, but I'm not going to say it now. I mean, this was the one area on which I saw him go very boot-faced. And there was no, all sense of humor had gone. It was as if I was asking him to kill his firstborn by pretending that he liked Tottenham.
That is so strange, because there's no natural rivalry between Liverpool and Spurs, I would say.
But he is a passionate Liverpool fan. So any other team are you know, lower life forms. And I think he regards Tottenham, a team that simply do not win anything ever, as a particularly low form of life.
Oh, well, this is the thing, Ken. You don't choose your team. Your team chooses you. So, you know, you locked into Spurs a long time ago, and that's the way it is.
Exactly. And you'll see the man that locked me in, Danny Blanchflower, has his name in white paint on the end of our terrace.
Precisely. And there's another thing as well I wanted to talk about in terms of the film, which is Van Morrison. Now, I'm a big Van Morrison fan, and clearly you are as well. And was that something that, again, was in the scripting process, or was that something that you found in the edit suite, this use of about, was seven, I'd say, seven or eight, maybe, Van Morrison
eight,
tunes?
Eight, including a new song, Down to Joy, which is the song that opens the film. It's hard not to think of Belfast music, which is rich and various, no question, always was, always will be, but without thinking of Van Morrison, who at the time the events of this film occurred, had been 2 years in the charts with Astral Weeks, an album that was being celebrated around the world, that included references to streets in Belfast and characters in Belfast. He was a big cultural ambassador. There were other 1960s tracks in the film to begin with, but in the end, the soul of Van Morrison's music, and on approaching him, his willingness to write a new song, but also to write this mood music, this incidental music, this solo saxophone and electric piano, which sort of expresses a certain kind of tender melancholy in those streets. It gave it a coherence, the whole thing, and an integrated, organic quality that felt entirely right for the story. He was, I was led to believe he was, you know, a challenging collaborator. I didn't find this. He spoke well about the script. It spoke to him. He has a complicated relationship to Ireland. Many of us do. And he helped us remix some of the master recordings for the movie mix. He gave us extra instrumentation and orchestration when we asked for it. And he was very sort of perceptive about a couple of cuts of the movie. So the entire sort of creative experience was a very joyful one. He's somebody you didn't have to say much to. He just went off and did what it was you needed him to do. And I had this sense of a man born to make music and work with music, just someone so predestined to be here to give it was a very fruitful collaboration.
In terms of choosing those songs, it's interesting. There's nothing from Astral Weeks in the film.
No. No.
Did you have a playlist?
We went through, I mean, a trillion songs were in there, and many more than eventually made the cut. But it just became, for instance, there's a really not so well-known but beautiful song, Stranded, that plays as the bus heads to the airport. And that has that, you know, Van saxophone on there, which is unmistakable. And it was we started to have songs, you know, that more clearly related to the other sounds he was making in the movie. But in some cases, they had sort of larger connections to a sort of different tapestry. For instance, his version of Carrick Fergus, which he sings as the father leaves the kid at dawn to head back across the water, is Van accompanied by the Chieftains, just on the late great Paddy Maloney there with the harp and with the bass. And that was another piece where I suppose most of the songs were relatively stripped down Van, with a couple of exceptions, and that particularly is one where, you know, Van's Irishness and that orchestra inner voice that he has is on display, and where he makes a common or garden to some people folk air, he transforms it into a sort of five act tragedy.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask about the writing process. And did this film pour out of you in a way? Were you able to plug back in to how people spoke back then? Uses of the Belfast vernacular, did that come naturally?
I think it did. I think it did. It's never been gone. And it always sort of secretly amuses me that people have me down, those who care about having me down in any way, as a sort of Oxbridge Shakespeare spouter. Nothing wrong with that, for somebody who, you know, was brought up being perplexed by phrases like I wasn't brought up the lock in a bubble, or you know, apples will grow again should they grow on a gooseberry tree, or just simply you're up the left, all of these I don't know where the left is, mum, but apparently I'm up it. And this was an improvised piece from Jude Hill. I just said, react to your father when he says this line. He's going to say to you, what's yours is mine, what's mine's me own. To which Jude replies, my granny says that, what does that even mean? What does it mean? And I found myself going back and thinking, well, I don't know what it means either, but I think it sounds nice.
Precisely. There's lots of stuff. I think every town has their own little phrases. Every yeah. family has their own little phrases. I remember my mum saying to me once, "I'll knock your melt in." And I have no idea to this day. I have no idea what a melt is. I don't know how you can knock it in, but there you go. So you can have that for free should there be a Belfast 2 down the line.
That's the kind of remark as my mother would say, Chris, you have me up the high door.
I do, absolutely. Absolutely. Ken, if we carry on much longer, this podcast may require subtitles. So I don't know. I find my accent gets stronger when I'm around, when I'm back home. I'm going back home for a few days and it's going to get pretty strong. Is that something I don't know. You do get back to Northern Ireland every now and again. I know.
I almost have always resisted that. When I went back for my first job, I went with a terrific actor, good Colm Convy, for one of the first Billy plays that we did back there and back in, you know, this is 1980. And Colm had the same background as me, came to England, spoke with an English accent. As the plane arrived, he said, "I'm Belfast now," and that was him off and running. And I've never been able to do that trick myself. So I'm almost more English when I'm in Belfast, more English sounding. But I enjoy, you know, I had a funny turn on Ben Elton's sitcom Upstart Crow Christmas special a couple of years ago, and I enjoyed being Colin and that, and. I enjoyed hearing the accent enormously, and it'd be nice to find. I'd love to do a great part in the accent. Maybe that'll happen at some point.
Yeah, it's interesting that this was written and directed by Kenneth Branagh, but not starring Kenneth Branagh. So that was never on the cards.
It was. I was in it at one stage. At one stage, an older version of Buddy, guess who played him, came back to Belfast. And I'm afraid the performance and the actor were not acceptable to me. So I've got to tell you, Chris, I cut him and I didn't even have the courtesy to drop him a line and explain why. I just cut him out of the movie. Tough.
Kent, you knocked his melt in. Catch yourself on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Pleasure as always talking to you. I could talk for many, many minutes more, but we have to wrap up. Kenneth Branagh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much indeed.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And there you go. Kenneth Branagh and me, two of the ones who left, as he says at the end of the film, talking about the wonderful Belfast. In case you're wondering, I didn't get back to Northern Ireland. I had COVID just shortly after that, so thankfully this was a Zoom interview and we spared Sir Ken the ignominy of contracting COVID from me. He would have knocked my melt in. Also, if you don't know the other black and white Michael Maloney film I was referring to, Watch in the Bleak Midwinter is another one of Branagh's best movies. It's a lovely, personal little trifle of a movie. So check that out, In the Bleak Midwinter. Anyway, that is it for this interview special, this Belfast interview special with Kenneth Branagh. Will this movie finally see him win an Oscar, whether it's for writing or directing or for Best Picture? Time will tell. But honestly, I can't help but admitting to a little home country bias and hoping that he snags at least one. Besides, the continued success of Belfast means that my spin-off idea based on my life growing up in Banbridge could be picked up at any moment. The current dramatic highlight of that movie is the time I got up to put a piece of paper in the bin in an economics class at school. I tripped, I fell backwards, I styled it out by doing a backwards roll, and was then given detention by the teacher for perceived disrespect and horseplay. Don't worry, folks. I'm over it now. It hasn't festered within me for decades. Anyway, this script won't write itself, more as a pity. So I'm off to do that. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.